We have been talking for the past few weeks about this big idea, which is we're a new group of people. We're a new church. I think this is week 12. Does anyone know what week it is? It's week 11, week 12. It's been amazing, but we're still new. And so it's important for us as a new group of people who have been meeting together to understand first things first, to understand the most important things. And kind of the idea that we're pursuing is, if the gospel authors were able to come and spend just a few minutes of their time with us, what would they say? If just in 30 seconds or 1 minute, if Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John could come to us and, you know, pull up a chair here and say, hey guys, this is really what I need you to understand. We saw that there's only one time in the four Gospels where they all say the same thing at the same time in the same way. Of all the miracles, of all the stories, of all the different teachings that they record of the life and times of Jesus Christ, outside of his death, burial, and resurrection, which they all record together as well, there's only one miracle that they all record. Does anybody have any idea what that miracle was? Does anyone remember? Yes, it was the miracle of feeding the 5,000. And we kind of said that if we look at the Gospels as a sugar cookie, the Gospels all have one point, which is Jesus Christ is God's miraculous provision, divine provision for the planet. He's a sugar cookie. He's amazing. And that if you know Jesus Christ, if you eat that sugar cookie, you're not going to be disappointed. He's going to satisfy you. We saw this in the miracle of the feeding of the 5,000, the loaves and the fishes. There was an apparent lack, and then Jesus showed up, and then everybody had plenty to eat. It's the only time Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John all say the same thing at the same time. And so he said that the core truth of the Gospels is that Jesus Christ is God's divine provision for the planet, even as, because that was the point of the feeding of the 5,000. If you come, you'll be fed, and you will not leave hungry. We said it's like a sugar cookie, and so you get a sugar cookie. You have to ask your wife's permission to have a sugar cookie? Maybe she needs a sugar cookie. So, we saw that the gospel is kind of like a sugar cookie, but each of these guys shape it differently. They use a different cookie cutter when they're talking about Jesus Christ. And so if the four of them were to come, they would all say, Jesus Christ is God's miraculous provision, God's divine provision for the planet. When it comes to matters of faith, the more you take in or partake of Jesus Christ, the more and more full you're going to be. You will not be disappointed. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they all say it, okay? We saw last week that Matthew uses a certain cookie cutter, if you will. He shapes his story about Jesus Christ in a certain way with a certain theme, and so we had a certain shape that helps us remember what that theme was, and that theme was that Jesus Christ is, he's a king. Oh, there's a lot of people that need sugar cookies this morning. I heard it over here. Is that you, Sarah? Did you say Jesus? Yes, Jesus Christ is the king who welcomes those who come to him. Matthew records, there's somebody over here that said it. Here we go. And we'll talk about this particular sugar cookie. This has got an interesting shape to it. This is this week's sugar cookie. So last week we saw it was a crown that Jesus Christ is the king who welcomes those who come. Matthew records in very clear terms, he begins with a genealogy tracing Jesus back through the kingly line of Israel. Matthew chapter 1, verse 1, this is where it starts. The life and times of Jesus Christ, he's a king. And he goes on where everyone that comes to Jesus Christ in the first 9 chapters of the book of Matthew kneel to him, beseech him, implore him. They treat him as a dignitary. They treat him as a king. And we talked about that a little bit, that that's a foreign concept for us. We don't have kings per se. The closest thing that we have to a king are like governors and presidents. And the biggest thing about them is that they're not accessible to us. They aren't the kind of men and women that we can just go and have a conversation with. But then Matthew in Matthew chapter 9 says, he's my king. I engaged personally with my king. And so we saw that the theme of Matthew is that Jesus Christ is a king who welcomes those who come. And so the question was, will we come? Will we come and kneel? Will we come and acknowledge Jesus Christ as the King? So the big idea, Jesus Christ is God's divine provision for the planet, God's gift for the planet. He satisfies miraculously and perfectly. But if you were to just take Matthew, he would say, he's my king, and I serve him. I've come to him. He has welcomed me. Kings are not known for their accessibility, but this king is. So come. Now, this week we're going to look at the Gospel of Mark, and we're going to pick up a different idea from the Gospel of Mark that supports what we've just recapped briefly. And Mark has a story to tell us. And here's what we see in the Gospels. We're going to see this with Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, that the things that are closest to their heart are the ones that rise to the surface of the text. So we saw with all of them that the feeding of the 5,000, it was a matter of the heart to them. That really meant something to them so that they all needed to share that particular miracle. Matthew, it was important to him that Jesus Christ was his king. And he came and he found welcome there. We're going to see another theme with Mark. But what these guys are doing is there's something about Jesus to them that is a matter of the heart to them, and it rises to the surface of their text. And so that's kind of the point of our study, is just to get that idea. This past week, part of the meeting these young men and women from Nashville was me being introduced to them as the guy who's basically going to be mentoring them, helping them understand, okay, great, you have all these talents, musical ability, and willingness to share. What does it actually look like when you're working with a guy who has started a church and everything's new and it involves a lot of work? And so I'm going to be mentoring them. So they wanted me to get to know them. So they asked me to send them some pictures so they could put together like a little video montage of like, you know, this is my life sort of a deal. And so it was like this kind of cool thing. They sang a few songs and their parents were there and it was all very nice. And then they showed this video that kind of gave a little bit of my backstory, and then ta-da, there I am, and it was amazing. So in the process of, they said, we want pictures from when you were in high school. We kind of want these young people to understand that you're from that area, you grew up in that area, you have family in that area, that you're the hometown guy that has a heart for his hometown. So we want high school pictures. Like, can't we do this any other way? For the same reasons that you would be reticent to share your high school pictures with complete strangers, plus the fact that, mercifully, there just aren't many high school pictures. So I had long hair. My hair came down to the end of my nose, and it's embarrassing. And I can go on. So I'm going through these pictures, but a theme rose up. A matter of my heart rose up. And it was interesting because as I'm going through these pictures, trying to find pictures to send to them, I'm finding all of these pictures of me and Trish. There's not many pictures, mercifully, of just me. It's me and Trish in Haiti. It's me and Trish in high school. It's me and Trish on our wedding day. It's me and Trish doing this. It's me and Trish doing that. And I'm like, wow. You know, I know that's not what they want, but I'm having a hard time editing out this theme in my life because it's pervasive. It's a matter of the heart. I can't tell my story. I can't even show you the pictures unless my wife is there. That's just who I am, and I'm very thankful for that. Mark feels the same way. Matthew feels the same way. I can't talk to you about Jesus without these ideas coming to the surface. I can't present to you who. What's also interesting too about Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John, they didn't write anything else. There's no other writings by these guys. It's their story. There's no other pictures with me with my arm around anybody else. It's not part of my story. And so with Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, it's not like there's competing versions of their gospels or other stories that they wrote about things that were important to them. No, there's just one thing, and it was Jesus. And these themes rise to the top of the text. And so we're going to see that this morning, that Mark prioritized a certain theme in the text because it's part of his story with who Jesus was. He knew him. So if you have your Bibles, turn to Mark chapter 1. We're going to take a look beginning in verses 1 through 3. We're just going to take a look at like two passages to try and point out this theme to you. And then as you read through the Gospel of Mark, you're going to see this. It just rises to the top. But let's identify it. Mark chapter 1, verses 1 through 3, it begins, "The beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God." Now, that's just the first sentence. What we're going to see, what's unique about the gospel according to Mark, as opposed to Matthew and Luke, which we studied last year, no shepherds, no angels, no gifts, no wise men, no stables, no Bethlehem, none of that stuff. Mark is just very, very clear that I am talking to you about the Son of God. There's no angel pronouncement. There's no old man standing in the temple with a vision. There's no virgin who has a baby miraculously. Nope, I'm just straight up telling you that this is a gospel of Jesus Christ, and gospel literally means the good news of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. As it is written in Isaiah the prophet, this is basically how Mark says, and I'm totally not kidding because I'm going to quote Israel's most famous prophet. As it is written in Isaiah the prophet, "Behold, I send my messenger before your face who will prepare your way. The voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make his paths straight." So in the first three verses, twice Mark says, I'm talking to you about someone that I am calling the Son of God, whose way is being prepared. The way that's being prepared is the way of the Lord. We're not preparing the way for John the Baptist. We're not preparing the way for another prophet. We're not preparing the way for another priest. We're preparing the way of the Lord. So twice in the first three verses, Mark's just not even cute. I'm talking about Jesus Christ, the Son of God, and John the Baptist is coming to prepare the way of the Lord. It continues, if you see, if you jump down to verse 9, now we begin to actually get to learn a little bit more about Jesus. What does this actually mean that he is the Son of God? That's the theme from the feeding of the 5,000, God's divine gift for the planet. Mark just comes right out and says it in the first three verses. Now he's going to begin to add his shape to who is Jesus Christ to Mark. Here we go. "In those days, Jesus came from Nazareth of Galilee and was baptized by John the Baptist in the Jordan. And when he, Jesus, came up out of the water, immediately he saw the heavens being torn open and the Spirit descending on him like a dove." Now, we have talked about this passage in the context of Luke and maybe a little bit in Matthew too in the past few weeks and a month or so. We've heard of the dove coming down. We've heard of Jesus being baptized, but the idea of the heavens being torn open, that's a new one. That's not something we've encountered before. That's not something you'll find in any other gospel. This is Mark indicating that this guy, the Son of God, the one that the way has been prepared for, he rips the heavens apart. There's power here. There's authority here. The other gospel writers, while it happened this way, they didn't record it that way. The heavens did open, and they did record that a dove came down and rested on Jesus, and then God made his pronouncement. But only Mark says that this guy ripped the heavens open. He also says that this happened immediately. If you read through the Gospel of Mark, the word immediately appears more times in Mark than in any other book of the Bible at all. And if you look at all the occurrences of that word in the Bible, half of them occur in Mark. In the first chapter alone, the word immediately occurs 11 times. And so Mark is basically saying here, I'm going to take a look just briefly at a few other passages, that Jesus is an authoritative man of action. For Matthew, Jesus is the king. He's the king that welcomes you when you come. Most kings are inaccessible. That's not the case with Jesus Christ. Mark says that Jesus Christ is an authoritative man of action. This is a guy that handles business, and he does it now. There's no question as to whether or not Jesus Christ just showed up in Mark's mind. Let's take a look at a few other things. If you have your Bibles, I don't have the words for these particular verses on the screen, but you can see just in Mark chapter 1, that's all where we're going to be this morning for the most part, is in Mark chapter 1 to establish this theme. We see that by verse 16 in Mark chapter 1, that he begins to call his first disciples. In Luke chapter 1, we're still talking about angels and girls and visions and dreams. And Matthew chapter 1, we're not even out of the genealogy by verse 16. In Mark chapter 1, we've already got Jesus Christ announced, baptized, and raising up his team. If you go on through Mark chapter 1, he is tempted in the desert. He has his first hand-to-hand, if you will, with the devil. As it goes on, beginning in verse 21, he does a healing in the synagogue where he wrestles with another evil spirit and wins. Beginning in verse 29, again, immediately he left the synagogue and entered the house of Simon and Andrew with James and John. Now Simon's mother-in-law lay ill with a fever, and immediately they told him about her, and immediately she was healed and began to serve him. And then we see that he performed many, many miracles in that area in Galilee. He preached an awful lot of sermons, and then the chapter concludes with him healing immediately a leper, a guy with a skin disease. And so we see in Mark chapter 1, just in the 30 or so verses that are there, he's named as the Son of God immediately. He immediately is baptized. The heavens are torn open as a sign of his authoritative power, something that's unique to Mark, that he does things immediately, that wherever he went, there was effective change. 11 times in the first chapter alone, the word immediately is used to describe Jesus' presence and actions. We also find that in Mark chapter 1, 6 times Mark references the fact that when Jesus showed up, he drew great crowds. There was a lot of interest in this guy. And this is why the shape for our sugar cookie this morning is a lightning bolt. Mark is describing Jesus Christ as an authoritative man of action like a lightning bolt. When a lightning bolt strikes, a couple of things happen. Number one, there's no doubt where the lightning was. Look for the smoldering evidence. Even there's a tree in our front yard, and you can always tell when a tree has had a lightning strike because there's a track down the tree that never goes away. It's like a little mini canyon that opens up in the tree, and sometimes that's where the dirt will start to collect, and sometimes you see little plants growing in there. That didn't just happen by accident. That was a lightning strike, and it grounded through the tree, and it split it open. There's no doubt that that tree was hit by lightning. Also, when a lightning strikes, it's attractional. Whatever it is you're doing, you say, oh, lightning. You notice it. And so Jesus' impact in Galilee was the same way. Mark says 6 times in chapter 1 that Jesus was attractional, that great crowds followed him everywhere he went. And then 5 times in chapter 1 alone, there's reference to his authority, like tearing the heavens open. That Jesus is a man of great authority, that this authority is attractional. It's not off-putting. People couldn't get enough of his teachings because, the text says, he taught them as not like one of the scribes or the lawyers of the day, but as someone who actually knew what he was talking about. And so this authority and this attractional quality and this immediate aspect to this man of action was like a lightning bolt. And so today's sugar cookie, the shape is a lightning bolt. So we have a crown. Jesus is a king. He welcomes those who come. That's Matthew. Mark is Jesus is a bold, authoritative man of action, like a lightning bolt. You can't ignore it. And you can see it coming from a mile away. And you're looking for it. And you can hear it. And you can sometimes smell it. And you can see where the lightning struck. Jesus had the same impact on Mark's life. And he records it as such. What does that mean for us? It means that God is at work, and that when we have been struck by Jesus Christ, we have a memory of that. You know, some of us can give the day and the minute and the hour of when we made a decision of faith. Some of us don't have that memory because we never did. But like being struck by lightning, there's a memory. And as we get to know Jesus better, our even as Jesus was attractional to his first century listeners, our attractions change. The things that appeal to us change. We start being attracted to new and different things the more and more we know this Jesus Christ that we find in Mark chapter 1. And also, finally, even as Jesus is authoritative and has the power to do things in Mark chapter 1, we too, our priorities change. Our the things that used to be important to us, maybe they're not so important, or maybe they're more important. Maybe there's relationships that we didn't value as much as we should have, but because we got struck by the lightning bolt, by the man of action that is Jesus Christ, we have a memory of that. We are and our priorities begin to change. And this is it's a whole nother conversation, it's a whole nother sermon, but it falls under the lines of, how do I know I'm actually a Christian? How do I know I'm actually a person of faith? It begins with the question, have you had an interaction with Jesus Christ, the authoritative man of action? Because when he walks into your life, he's going to make a memory. And you can prove it because your attractions begin to change, you're attracted to different things, and your priorities begin to change, even as it happened in the first century. The power of what Mark is saying in Mark chapter 1. I love this idea of authority. I have a friend that shared this with me recently. He has 4 little ones, a 1-year-old, a 3-year-old, a 5-year-old, and a 6-turning-7-year-old, 2 daughters and 2 boys. And his wife homeschools, and his wife was teaching his oldest daughter, who is 6-turning-7, how to be authoritative with their dog, whose name is Bella, because Bella's kind of young and kind of impetuous, and it would help mom if the children had a little bit of authority, a little alpha thing going on with this teenage dog, essentially, puppy transitioning to an adult, Bella. I believe she's a boxer. And so mom was teaching her oldest daughter to say, Bella, get in your cage. And she was saying, you know, when you say this, you have to lower your voice. Bella. You know, a 6-year-old girl, 7-year-old girl. Bella, get in your cage. No, sweetie. Bella, get in your cage. And so, of course, my friend hears what's going on. He comes into the room and goes, Bella, get in the cage. And the dog goes, bark, and, you know, whoop, right into the cage. Her little kennel where it was nap time or bedtime or whatever. And so mom is working with, and she's impressing upon her daughter the importance of, if this animal is going to listen to you, you have to be authoritative. You have to require certain behavior, and the trigger is the tone of your voice. So, you know, cute little adorable 6-7-year-old girl, you can't make it a question, you can't make it a request, and you can't use your normal voice. Bella, get in the cage? No, it's Bella, get in the cage. And then, burp, she runs in the cage. So the boy, who is 5, has been listening to this, and he goes, Mom, get me a snack. And then there was a whole new series of lessons that had to be taught in that household. Because it didn't work. And so we find, however, in the life of Jesus Christ, it's not just that he is the king and that we kneel to him. We should. You know, we looked at the text that we either kneel to him now willingly, or the Bible's very clear that we're going to kneel to him later, whether we want to or not. And so we saw that Jesus is the king. But we also see in Mark that it's attractional, that it's the kind of authority that comes with a level of good, positive, comforting change. People are healed. The devil is suppressed. New life starts. Miracles happen. The guy has words to say with actual authority, because when you put your faith in them, things start to change for you. Your attractions are different. Your priorities are different. It's like being struck by lightning. Jesus is an authoritative man of action. In my study for this text, one of the things that I kind of had to wrestle with, this question came up in my mind, and maybe it's occurred to you too. So perfect. Jesus Christ is an authoritative man of action. He has 2 hand-to-hand combats with evil forces in Mark chapter 1. He's healing all over the place. He's teaching like he knows what he's talking about. People are attracted to this. So if his authority is so amazing, why is it a case-by-case thing? why is it this thing where if, why can't he just walk into one of these crowds that are surrounding him, not only in Mark chapter 1, but all through the Gospel of Mark, Jesus is attracting crowds. Why can't Jesus just stand there and say, hey, presto, everybody's healed? If he's that powerful, if he's that authoritative, and, you know, if you've been in church at all, you've heard that he's that kind, he's that loving, that he's God's son, and that he's God's greatest gift for the planet, why does he pace himself this way? Why this personal interaction with people who need healing? Why didn't Jesus start a school for preachers, for instance? Instead of just preaching to the people who came to hear him, why didn't he start a school? Instead of just healing the people that came to him to be touched by him, why didn't he do one of two things? Heal them all like that. If he's really like a lightning bolt, surely there's power to do that. And there is. You can't say that there isn't. Why didn't he start a hospital? You know, why can't we graduate from the Jesus Christ School of Medical Practice? Why can't we graduate from the School of Jesus Christ of Powerful Preaching? If this guy has all this authority, why didn't he institutionalize himself? I don't know. Maybe that never even occurred to you. I don't know. This is what I do, though. I think about this stuff, and I read the Bible, and I ask questions, and sometimes I come up with ideas like this, which force me to go back into the text for answers, because I can't answer that question. That's what I would do. If I had the power to heal like that, I wouldn't make you come and find me. I'd just do it, right? If you know, and then I'd start a hospital. You know, if I could preach the way he preached, where people just came and I didn't have to print any brochures or have websites or Facebook, you better believe I'd be doing that. And then I'd start a school. I would institutionalize it. So why doesn't Jesus do this? It's not because he doesn't have the authority to do it. You don't argue with a lightning bolt. It has power. It's inherent in who he is. He has power. The answer's in the text. And it's the last scripture that I'd like to share with you. And it's one of the last passages in the book of Mark. It's the only other time we see the heavens tore open in the Gospel of Mark. It's the only other time where we see unilateral, world-changing power. Because he does have the authority to be unilateral. He does have the authority to heal everybody instantly. He does have the authority and power to do it, but it wasn't applied in healing and it wasn't applied in preaching. That's the job of the church. That's our job. That's my job. That's your job. He empowers us to do it. So what is the one area, the one time where he rips the heavens open again and acts unilaterally as God, divinely? He's not asking anyone's opinion. He's not asking if anyone is sick. He's not asking if he has a problem he can authoritatively preach and help you with. He's just using his power like a lightning bolt, and the heavens rip open. It's the only other time in the Gospels that we see this applied. Mark chapter 15. And Jesus uttered... You can read it. What does it say there? Somebody help me out. It's the only other time that word appears. The veil separated Jews from the part of the temple where God resided, where his presence was, in the Holy of Holies. And again, that's a whole nother sermon. It's the only other time that word appears in the Gospel of Mark, where something is getting torn by an act of God's power. So when Jesus chooses to act unilaterally, without asking our opinion, to heal, to provide power instantly, it's when he died. And if we didn't get the point that the veil of the temple was torn in two, he has a complete pagan mercenary pop up in the text, a walk-on character who has had no experience with Jesus Christ whatsoever except looking at him as someone who belongs to a subjugated people group. And he concludes, not because he saw that the temple curtain was torn, he wasn't in the temple, he was at the site of the crucifixion, but because he saw the manner in that in this way he breathed his last, truly, this man was the Son of God. The point of every gospel, the sugar cookie, Jesus Christ is God's divine provision for the planet. This guy gets why. He saw a lightning strike. He saw a lightning strike. And Mark records, the only other time in his gospel where this word is used, that the heavens were parted again, this time on the planet. Physically, a curtain was torn from top to bottom that separated people from the presence of God in the temple in Jerusalem. That floors me. And it helps me a little bit with the question about if Jesus is that amazing, why hasn't he done this right now? Because the answer kind of is he's dealing with an issue that actually is more important. Because at the end of the day, his presence is available to us. Nothing stands in the way. Nothing. It gets ripped apart if it does, like a lightning bolt. He is not a respecter of persons. He just strikes. He acts. He is a man of authoritative action. And I guess the question for, and I'm good. Are we good? We're good? Let's end this. We're at a good place to end this, right? So worship team, if you would help us out, we're going to have a time to worship the Lord and to pray and to sing again. But while they're getting ready and helping me finish our time together this morning, to go back to our opening thought, that when Mark tells his story, and this is the only story he has to tell, there's no competing texts, there's no other literary works that are written by Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John, outside of the ones that show up in the New Testament later on, written by John, that when Mark tells his story, this theme rises to the top immediately. Attractional, authoritative, right in the first chapter, and it continues throughout. And even as if you were to dig through my high school photographs, you would have a hard time finding any picture worth looking at that didn't have my wife in it. It's just a theme in my life. It's just the way it is. So this theme rises to the surface in Mark's gospel. And next week, we're going to take a look at Luke, and the week after, we're going to take a look at John and identify what the cookie cutter that they used to shape their interaction with Jesus Christ. But the question this morning is, when the time comes for you to tell your story, what's the theme? What rises to the top? When you sift through your old photographs, your old memories, your experiences, when we boil who you are down to just some big ideas and some big themes, what rises to the top? Is, in Matthew's gospel, Jesus your King, that welcomed you when you came. Your experience with authority hasn't always been so good, but when you came to Jesus Christ, he welcomed you. And so you happily serve him because you found something there that you never found anywhere else. Does that theme rise up in your album? Or like Mark, do you look at a tree in the front yard that has a streak running down it and say, I was impacted by Jesus Christ, and here's the evidence of it. My heart started to change. My attraction started to change. My priorities started to change. Is that how you feel about Jesus Christ? Or is he just not a theme in your life at all? And that's a question that we all have to answer for ourselves. The good news is that there's a lot of guidance in God's word. And I hope that in the short time that we've had today and last week, in the short time we have in the weeks to come, that you'll hold on to these themes. That's why we do the goofy sugar cookie. If for nothing else, you can hopefully remember the crown or the lightning bolt and think about these themes as they appear in the gospel, that they would encourage you as you either allow Jesus to be a part of your story and begin taking new pictures, or rejoice and are strengthened in your faith as you see how important it has been to you, and it gives you courage for the future. So I'm going to pray with us, and then we have an opportunity to sing one song and a time to pray and to think. There are more lightning bolt sugar cookies. If you're interested, there's also some donuts and things out there and coffee as well. We're not in any hurry. We'd love to stay around and chat if you're so inclined. Would you join me as I pray?